So, Michael, in your expert response, you said that whether we should try and adjust our speeds for wind and for weight in a real emergency is another discussion. But let's have that discussion. Should we try and adjust speed for wind and weight if we're really gliding in an emergency? And if so, how would we do that? How would we train that when you know, you even said the math can get pretty complicated?
Well, Jeff, I think you just hit it right on the head from the very beginning. It's training, right? And I think now in private pilot training, there's not much thought given to that, right? So every number that a pilot recites is essentially that. It's a rote number. What's best rate of climb? What's best angle of climb? What's best glide speed? But there's really no science behind that other than you're just taking it at face value, like we talked about. And I think to improve private pilots in the future or current pilots, I think a better understanding of what your aircraft's weight is every time you're flying it, even while you're burning fuel, and how that would adjust best glide speed. So it's one of the things that when we talk about situational awareness, that's sort of on the fringes of situational awareness, is actually how much does my airplane weigh and how does that affect maneuvering speed and best glide speed and all of those things. So to me, it almost would be a paradigm shift for today's current flight instructors to actually make the person aware of the weight of their airplane and how that's going to affect different things in an emergency.
You know, I find that the numbers crunching discussion a bit wonkish. One thing that's really helpful in best glide is just knowing the attitude for best glide. And in just about every GA airplane that I've ever been in, just level flight. If you put the chord line of the wing level with the horizon, you're within a couple of knots of best glide. So, you know, when we teach this stuff, there's a concentration on the numbers, and you see people, you know, pitching all over the sky, chasing their best glide speed. And, you know, a better practice, especially in an emergency, is just fly level and let the speed sort itself out, because in very short order, it'll be within a couple of knots of best glide.
Well, strangely, again, I'm with Dave, but that's what we teach. Most people probably know that my day job is with American Bonanza Society, and we have a very active pilot training program. And we teach pitch attitudes. We actually teach a pair of attitudes, one before you reduce propeller RPM per the best glide checklist, and then one after. And Dave's exactly right. Even in an airplane like a 3,600-pound A36 Bonanza, once you've got the propeller in the glide position, it's about a level flight attitude. It's very strange, because you're level, but you're descending at about 900 foot per minute. We teach the pitch attitudes that, to some extent, compensates for the weight automatically. It does not address the wind issue that Michael brought up, which frankly I hadn't thought very much about before.
You know, back in the late 70s, early 80s, when gas was cheap, we did a lot more in terms of spot landing contests and flower bombing and stuff like that. And I know it's wonkish, but we worked out something back in those days. I didn't do it, and I got it from someone else. But we adjusted the glide speed, the best glide speed, by taking the amount that we were below maximum gross weight, percentage-wise. For instance, in this case, it was 7%. And we cut that in half, 3.5%, and then reduce the best glide speed by 3.5%. So in this case, it would be, 2.3 knots. So it would take you down to 64.7 knots. And then you'd work from there. Although in those days, we didn't incorporate the glider stuff, you know, half the wind velocity adding onto it. We just sort of approximated that, because none of us in those days were glider rated, and we didn't appreciate that part of it. But that's how we computed it back when.
Jeff, this case illustrates why these scenarios are so helpful, because we can all sit here at zero knots in 1G and think about this scenario and what we would have done. When I first read it and looked at it, my brain hurt. I was like, I don't know about all this math. But we can sit here and think through it. And now the real practical implication is, just like Dave Hirschman said, if you were to have a real engine out, you'd want to get the plane to a level attitude, and that's close enough while you work a bunch of different things you got going on. But in the latter stages, if you find, I'm not going to make this field, it's really close, I need to improve my glide, what are you going to do? You're going to do what we learned in this scenario and lower your nose and add airspeed to half the wind factor. So it's really a valuable lesson.
I really like the simplicity of that, Richard, the way you just summed that up, you know, because you're either going to make it or you're not from your energy state, right? If you're at the most efficient thing, and if the wind is too much in your face, well, maybe, you know, if you pitch down a little bit, you could change the situation just enough to make enough forward progress or not, but there's nothing you could do in a real engine out there. So, you know, we can at least try it. I like the simplicity of that.
Yeah. Well, Jeff and Richard, thanks for stealing my thunder there, because that was my thing, but that's okay. But I was just going to say, the math makes my head hurt too, but it's one of the things that I learned after going through this is exactly that. And if the pilots that are participating in this understand that if you're into a headwind and you might not make it, it's against our training to actually pitch the nose forward. We all want to pull the nose up to try to stretch the glide, but it's counterintuitive to pitch the nose forward, which is exactly what we want to do. And I think that's, to me, that's the takeaway from this. If you're into a headwind and you might come up short, dropping the nose just a couple of degrees from your normal pitch attitude, glide attitude, might help you get there.
And I know Goulian is a competitive guy. I'm just pleased in this scenario that he didn't decide to jettison his extra weight and throw those poor spectators at the window.
You know, I had to convince him to take that out of the script. It just, you know, has to stay kind of a family-friendly event here. And the flower bombing competition had already happened, so, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't talk about, you know, turning your smoke pump on and dumping your smoke and all of that stuff, but that's okay.
Right. And, you know, the GA equivalent of speed to fly, in my mind, is kind of the Carson speed. And if you ever get a chance to read the Carson's paper on fuel efficiency in travel, it's really interesting, and it boils down to the best compromise of all speeds that we can fly in a normal GA airplane is the best glide speed plus a third is your indicated airspeed. Tom likes to use the bonanzas, you know, best glide speed in the A36 is 110 knots, add about a third, so it's low 140s indicated airspeed. The highest altitude at which you can fly in the low 140s indicated is your sort of best compromise speed. But it opens up all the glider stuff opens up some fascinating aerodynamic questions about, efficiency and how we can improve. There's a lot we can learn in GA about how to improve it.
Well, Dave already went into the detail I was going to talk about Carson speed, and it is interesting because, just to reiterate what he said, the airplane's most efficient in terms of distance for fuel burned, even if that fuel is zero in the case of an engine out glide, it's most efficient in distance for fuel burn at best glide speed, but it's also slow. And so by picking up just a little bit, you don't lose very much in terms of fuel burn, assuming the engine's running, but you do pick up the speed. Interestingly enough, since we keep drawing the Bonanza back in, I have flown one or two other airplanes. Interestingly enough, for most Bonanzas and similar airplanes, the indicated airspeed in normal cruise, the way we normally fly the airplane, is very close to Carson speed.
Yeah, I was going to bring up sometime in my distant past, I had a flight instructor who was a flight test engineer. And he'd like to do a lot of stuff with numbers. So we went up a piece of graph paper. We did the LD bucket. We flew all the speeds up to the point where we got into the region of reverse command behind the power curve, put all those numbers together and had a little matrix to understand that. I found it was very useful. But what I took from that, and which I passed on to students when I started instructing, is that where you're most likely to use this, where it's most going to be practical, is in landings when the airplane is light. Pilots routinely fly airplanes that are quarter tanks, they're light, one person in it, and they fly approach speeds that are too fast. They end up doing wheelbarrows and porpoising and runoff runways. When in fact, when you do the math, even if you do the math in your head using the simple formula, you find you're going to shave 5 knots off the approach speed easily. And that makes a big difference in the quality of the landing and the distance for the rollout. And that to me is the most practical thing. I don't remember if I was ever trained to consider the wind, and I'm not sure that I would under duress. I think if you can just get the airplane in visual condition, get the airplane in a good glide configuration and find a place to put it, you're way ahead of the curve.
Well, to your question, and hopefully it's not diverting the discussion now, but to your question, how do we practice that? The scenario didn't use the term, but the contestant pilots in the scenario were doing the power off 180 maneuver, pulling the power to idle opposite the touchdown spot and making a continuous glide. So the way to practice this, to learn to incorporate the wind, would be number one, to practice the power off 180 and get good at that. And then number two, come out here to Kansas and do it again to see the effect of wind. As a matter of fact, I'm thinking I need to get the airplane out and try that a little bit.
Well, if you do, grab some video on it and it will put it on the site.
I'm experimenting with capturing video. That would be a really good program. Yeah,
It'd be a fun one. Maybe Richard and Dave can do the same. They got a wind howling down the runway someday. Watch what happens.
Come on out here if you want, Richard. I'd love to fly with you.
I think Paul brought up a really good point about coming around to landings. And I'm glad you went there, Paul, because that is, you know, probably the most practical. And every single flight, you could potentially put this into practice a little bit. Michael said he does it all the time in the Cirrus. And that's something I learned when I first started flying the 22 was the first time actually I had heard that. And it was from one of the pilots actually at Cirrus. It was like, hey, here's a quick hack for you. And it's great. And it was fantastic. So how about that? You know, we don't all fly the Cirrus where it's one, you know, not for every 100 pounds. How does a pilot figure that out for their airplane and put it in practice and see whether it's really, really working? Or is there a better way than trying to do the math?
I think you just do exercises and basically with an emphasis on flying the slowest possible approach speed that you're comfortable with. When I fly the Cub, basically the only thing to do is landings because I'm not going anywhere in it. So there's a little grass strip down here and I go down and work on landings. And sad to say, they still kind of suck most of the time, but you learn some things about how slow you can really fly an airplane. When we had a Mooney, we had a 201, it had an angle of attack indicator in it, one of the early ones. And I never really trusted the thing until I started to learn that if I put the needle in the notch, this thing would really fly slow. I mean, it would fly at an indicated airspeed of something like 58 with full flaps, perfectly comfortable, touchdown, and you'd basically stop. But you don't need that equipment to do that. You can do it by feel and by observational experience. But the only way to do it is to just practice it and practice it a lot. And as Tom said, that power off 180, I seem to recall that's on the commercial test. That's a very valuable exercise. It really teaches you how the airplane is going to behave at various speeds. But you got to go out and actually practice it.
Yeah, I like the idea of going to practice it in just different scenarios. You know, most of us very rarely fly our airplanes at max gross weight. And so when we fly, we're looking for a reason to go fly. Just take off in whatever configuration you happen to be in, just go stall it. See where it stalls that day. And you'll just begin to build sort of a situational awareness in your average configuration or typical. Your airplane tends to stall at, you know, whatever the knots are. And just having that sort of essay about your airplane is helpful.
I'm liking the all the emphasis on practice in this this discussion because in the scenario, the sort of glaring red warning light keeps popping off in my mind is that, you know, this pilot is kind of making it up as he goes, and he's getting himself in a situation which I'm not sure he's practiced, where he's like, okay, I'm heavyweight, into the wind, let me dump the flaps and land. And it just seems like, you know, haven't seen a few of these spot landing efforts go wrong. You know, I would hate to see this airplane banged up or p- put on its nose because the pilot is doing something at the event when everybody's watching that the pilot has not practiced before.
I think practicing short field landings allows you to develop an awareness of your airspeed. Most of these light airplanes that we fly give you a short field landing speed for gross weight, full gross weight. And if you're flying the airplane at 10, 15, or 20% below gross weight, you're going to find that when you go out and practice your short field landings using that final approach speed published in the POH, that you're going to float a ways down the runway. That gives you some indication that you're too fast. And here again, my rule of thumb is to reduce the short field landing speed by half of the percentage that you are in fact below maximum gross weight. So if you're 10% below gross weight, reduce your speed by 5%. And that will allow you to get more in the realm of what's appropriate for a short field landing. But that's a good exercise to learn to control the airspeed.
You know, listening to all of these, and I really appreciate what you said, Dave, about all this about practice, how you like there's practice in here. For a lot of our scenarios, this is a, you know, there's an emergency takeaway or an urgency or anything, but this one seems to really inspire, like, go out and mess around safely. Don't, you know, ding up an airplane over this, but someday when the wind is howling right down the runway, do some power off 180s and see what happens when you turn into that wind and what it takes to make forward progress or not. You know, go out, like you said, and try stalls at lower weights, even when you're completely alone, just partial tanks, and see what this airplane does. Try pitching for level flight, if power off, without cover that airspeed indicator, and then see what it is, see what the number came out to be, and see how close that is to your corrected best glide speed, and come up with an easy way for yourself. Whatever works, whether it's math or a hack or an estimate or just a particular attitude that's just right on landing, so that you always are flying a corrected attitude, a corrected angle of attack, instead of being absolutely fixed on a certain number from the POH that actually only applies in a very small number of situations.